You are listening to Down Home.
In this episode, me and Jay will be taking a look at the Netflix film Rustin, starring the talented Coleman Domingo and directed by George C. Wolfe, with a screenplay by Julian Rees and Dustin Lance Black. Be aware there are spoilers in this episode. If you haven't watched the Netflix movie Rustin yet, proceed with caution. We'll be talking about its most pivotal moments. Have you heard of Bayard Rustin? If not, you're not alone. Despite his monumental impact on American history, Rustin's name often remains in the shadows of the civil rights movement. In this episode, we talk about aspects of the remarkable life and legacy of Bayard Rustin as seen in the movie Rustin. One of Rustin's most significant but often unrecognized roles was in organizing the historic 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. As a brilliant strategist and master of nonviolent resistance, Rustin played a crucial behind-the-scenes role in the success of the march. Yet his sexuality as an openly gay man at a time of intense prejudice led to his contributions being sidelined and his story obscured. Join us as we have a discussion about the complexities of Rustin's life, his pivotal role in the civil rights movement, and the unfortunate erasure of his impact due to societal biases. Rustin is more than just a movie, it's a tribute to a remarkable individual whose legacy continues to inspire and challenge us today. I'm Derek Wise, and on behalf of Jay Jones, welcome to Down Home, the Canadian experience from two black men. Breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, sip a breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, sip a breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, sip a breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground. So. Yeah, what were your thoughts?
I thought it was it's a part of history I didn't know. It's so weird. You know, we do all these podcasts and we talk about these things, things that gone on in history. But then when you actually put a visual to it, it changes it. It changes your perspective just in the sense of it connects you with it more, I guess, because it's a sense that you're really – you know, engaged in. And what got me was the imagery of I can't remember her name right now. It was Ruby, who the first little kid that got integrated into school.
Yeah.
When, like, it was just such an image. She's skipping along. She's a kid. And then, you know, there's all kinds of people with guns and police, and she's in between them, and it just set this scene. And then other people, when segregation happened, you see, especially in the high school in the film, you see all these white kids yelling at the black person, ganging up on them, beating mm-hmm. them or whatever. And there were even some whites that stood beside black people for some of these protests, and they were under the same guise of as if they were black. So, I mean, it just transports you back to that time. But with that being said, I really enjoyed it just from the perspective of some of the scenes where there was one, they're outside of some city hall or something, and these white people walk by, and the black people, Rustin and some of his crew were there, they're all dressed in suits. And one guy, he's an older gentleman that joins them, and he's like, "What, you haven't seen a proud black man before?" And it just sort of took me back to that time of even when we grew up, like how proud, you know, our families were, regardless of what they went through. I can't imagine what it was like in the States, but it seemed like a time of pride. So that really caught my eye, because the civil rights movement was a time when all the black communities got together and tried to stand up for something. You know, they had broken down the Jim Crow laws, and now they're marching on, you know, Capitol Hill 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. That's pretty
yeah,
epic.
Yeah. I didn't know anything about the movie or Bayard Rust before I actually watched the movie. So I was kind of coming into a cold. I didn't even know that Coleman Domingo was starring in it. And I really like his work, of course.
Yeah.
And in Fear the Walking Dead and some of the other projects. So I think he's a fantastic actor.
Yeah, he was in Euphoria as well.
Yeah, he was the
mentor counselor, the ex-addict.
Yeah,
yeah.
But you're right. Like the beginning scene, I think it was it comes up and it says 1954, which is when they ended school segregation in most parts of the states.
Yeah, but the Jim Crow laws didn't end yet.
No, they did not. But that was just segregate. That was school segregation.
Yeah,
and I made a couple notes, and the one thing that I noted was it was like white anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was white anger about these little kids going to the same schools that they're going to.
Yeah.
That's what I got out of that. And you're right. The imagery was very interesting. Like that one scene that you're talking about of the young girl skipping to school and she's surrounded by National Guardsmen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
which actually happened.
No, it did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so it was that.
Yeah. But, the other thing, like I said, I think, Coleman Domingo did a great job.
He
embodied the Bayard's kind of struggle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause he's human. Right.
Right.
And there was a quote that he said to, I forget who he said it to, but he said, when he took a leave of absence from his job after he saw that, I think it was Medgar Evers passed away. Oh no, sorry. It wasn't when it was a few days after Medgar Evers passed away and the stuff in Birmingham happened.
Yes.
And so you saw like people being dragged around, dogs being sicked on people. Yeah.
The hoses and everything.
The hoses.
Yeah.
And one of his co-workers says to him, we want to, when you come into this workspace, you have to leave your differences behind. Right. He was saying all this stuff. And Bayard says to him, I can't surrender my differences because the world won't let me.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that included his blackness, his sexuality, right?
Yeah.
And his idealisms. The world wouldn't let him do that, right?
Yeah. He was raised by his great. That's what actually was what caught my eye too. Just him saying, he was raised by his grandparents, which happened a lot.
Mm.
Over generations, we were.
Yeah.
So I connected with that.
Bayard Rustin, born on March 17, 1912 in Westchester, Pennsylvania, was a pivotal figure in the American Civil Rights Movement. Raised by his grandparents, Julia and Jennifer Rustin, he was exposed to activism from a young age. In his early years, Rustin's passion for social justice was ignited by his grandmother, Julia, who was a member of the NAACP. Growing up in a Quaker household, he was instilled with values of nonviolence and equality, principles that would shape his activism in the years to come. Rustin attended Wilberforce University, a historic black college in Ohio, but his time there was brief. He was expelled for leading a campus-wide protest against the poor quality of the cafeteria food. He later moved to New York City, where he became involved in the vibrant cultural and political scene of Harlem during the 1930s. In these formative years, Rustin began developing his skills as an activist. Influenced by the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi and his commitment to nonviolent resistance, his early activism included organizing protests against racial segregation in public transportation, foreshadowing his later work in the civil rights movement.
But he also... He thought his mother was actually his sister for the longest time. Yeah. He was raised, his family was actually quite wealthy. They were caterers. And so he grew up in a big house of 12 kids, and he was basically considered one. So for years, he thought his mother was his sister. What really amazed me was the fact that he, even though the world wouldn't let him, he still did. He still was himself.
Yeah, man.
And there was a quote from his grandmother that I read. He had discovered that he was like, "Grandma, I think I like the company of boys." He goes, "I like being around boys." And she just said, "Well, I guess you have to do it then." You know what I mean? Like, and I just thought, wow, that, like, his grandmother, like, really was just, you know what I mean? Like, it also reminded me of a time when Black families were a lot closer, I think, you know, and there was such strength in numbers. That's what I really took from it, was the community and how it takes a village to get stuff done, and how proud they were and how educated they were and how they stood up against, you know, the system.
Yeah, there was a lot of hurdles he had to jump over, like, well, first of all, our community, I'm sure it's changed, but a lot of the Black people in the States and the older Black populace, well, actually just Black people in Canada in general, we're actually quite conservative, small C conservative.
Yeah.
So, you know, for someone like him to openly be gay, and he was also dating a young white man. All that, I looked it up. All that stuff is true.
Yeah.
The two relationships that they depicted in the movie were true. The young white man named Tom. And
Elias, man, I think,
and Elias, the Black Taylor, Reverend, that he had the affair with. All that's true, right? Yeah. Which just humanizes him, if anything, right? But those were, you know, he loved who he loved, right?
Yeah. And I mean, he even said that in one of the scene when one of the partners, the white partner, finds out. He said, "I have feelings for him."
Yeah. But the fact that because he was the architect, the actual organizer of the March on Washington.
Yeah.
And for history to put him aside because of his sexuality, it's disgusting.
Yeah, it totally is.
One of the main hurdles Rustin faced was navigating the complexities of the various civil rights organizations involved. From the NAACP to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Rustin had to coordinate and unify these groups towards a common goal. The movie depicts this well. Despite his organizational and planning skill, Rustin faced immense challenges due to his identity as an openly gay man. At a time when homosexuality was heavily stigmatized, there were concerns within the movement about the potential backlash against Rustin's involvement. And there were political and government leaders like Strom Thurmond and J. Edgar Hoover who attempted to use Rustin's involvement as a means to discredit the march. Despite these obstacles, Rustin persisted, tirelessly working to ensure the success of the march. He was the chief architect of the logistics, coordinating transportation, security, and the overall program for the event. Rustin's influence was felt in every aspect of the march, from its peaceful and organized nature to its emphasis on nonviolent protest. However, despite his crucial role, Rustin's name was absent from the official list of organizers and speakers for the march. In hindsight, the reasons why seemed draconian and backward. The event leaders were concerned about his sexuality, his past ties to left-leaning organizations, and they wanted to present a more mainstream image of the civil rights movement to the American public. In the end, while Bayard Rustin's contributions to the 1963 March on Washington were indispensable, he remained largely unrecognized in the official narrative of the event. It wasn't until years later that his pivotal role began to receive the recognition that it deserved, as historians and activists shed light on his immense contributions to the fight for civil rights and equality in America.
Well, back then, homosexuality was considered illegal.
Yeah, so, it was. Yeah. For most states, it was actually illegal. Yeah, which is...
Which is, we've come a long way.
Well,
I mean, you would in that regard, I mean, I'm not saying it's still, at least it's not illegal.
Yeah, it's not illegal, but yes. in the court of public opinion.
Yeah, everything.
Like all this stuff still holds, man. It all holds.
Well, that's the thing. And also, he was also a big proponent in New York for getting their school system integrated as well. It was a one day demonstration. It wasn't a march. It was a demonstration. And it had 400,000 people, mainly Puerto Ricans and Blacks, who all boycotted and even got some of the teachers to come together and stand inside. The union didn't comply, but they said they would help anyone who received backlashes. And the whole meaning was to integrate the school system. And, you know, he was very passionate about it, saying how it would benefit everybody. A lot of hurdles, you know, it didn't quite stick at first, but he just seemed to be a passionate man in everything that he did. He was also an accomplished tenor singer.
The movie did illustrate that. Yeah,
recorded lots of albums, and he went for a trip to Africa and learned some Negro spirituals and everything like that. It was a pretty interesting dude who I did not know anything about, you know, because it was swept aside.
His whole history was swept aside, and the fact that he was a very good friend of Martin Luther King Jr. And his kids considered him uncle.
Yeah,
and the rift that his exportation from the NAACP for all those years, the rift that caused between the two of them, all that stuff is true. Again, I researched it, man. It is all true.
Yeah,
and they did come back and work together to put together the March on Washington, which, you know, I didn't. The logistics of it, I had no idea that it was such a huge task, and the amount of resistance that they faced from like Washington city officials.
Yeah,
like the original march was meant to be a 2-day affair.
Yeah,
the officials basically said no, 1 day.
Yeah,
and they actually mobilized every single cop in Washington, the National Guard, and everything to stand around this group of Black people, just for literally the color of their skin.
Yeah. And, you know? And it was a peaceful protest, as was the one in New York as well. That was, people were always moved by this, that with that one in particular, that there was no violence. You know what I mean? So,
Well, that was his credo. Like, I don't know if it's true because I didn't research this, but according to, he was having a, in one scene, he was having a discussion with, Elias Taylor in that, the bar. And, he claimed to say when he met Martin Luther King, when he started to get, getting noticed by the authorities and getting arrested, he had guns in his house, right? And Bayard claimed in the movie to be the one to help MLK adopt his nonviolent stance.
Which
really set him apart from other leaders of the time, like Malcolm X, right?
Yeah, because when Malcolm X first started, they were by any means necessary, right?
Yeah.
He seemed to have that approach of, peaceful protesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting, though. The other thing that I found interesting was the amount of fundraising that they had to do. And the Black celebrities that were involved in helping them raise money.
Big time. And even some of the white celebrities, too, like some big ones. Marlon Brando, Burt Lancaster at the time. It was, I just found it amazing that to see, you know, all those people sort of coming together and just like John Lewis, like A. Randolph was named. He put the union together, the port, you know, all the he formed the. So it was kind of cool to see how all these people who were like minded going, oh, man, there's strength in numbers, obviously. And they did a lot. They got out there. It was a lot of grassroots stuff, like going out there into, you know, into the neighborhoods. And once, and they were also very eloquent speakers, which, you know, which also helped their cause, you know, to rally passion and take a look at things differently, you know?
Yeah.
So
I do like the fact that the movie didn't sugarcoat the amount of, conflict and discord they had within these organizations, though.
Yeah, that was the other thing too.
That I think that was quite realistic. Like the even the discord between those who were like the any means necessary civil rights activists and the nonviolent resistance. There was a part that party scene to kind of illustrate that.
Yeah.
Which was a big thing.
Yeah.
Like there were a lot of civil rights activists. They were not in the minority. There was a lot of civil rights activists, especially black civil rights activists that believed that the nonviolent approach was not the right way to go.
That's true. And you know, that often backfired because, you know, the FBI and they were all in for violence. So, and then they painted the narrative, oh, well, look, they're trying to cause an uprising. So, I actually wanted to ask you that question, actually, when I was sort of researching and watching the movie. Where would you stand, like, in that regard as a violence to nonviolent? Do you think was more effective?
As a young man back then, I probably would have been sitting up there in Elijah Muhammad's temple, man. No, I'm serious. As a young man in my 20s, because, you know, when I was younger, I had trouble suffering fools, and and if I was in that era, I think I would have been right beside Malcolm X. I don't think I would have been in the nonviolent camp at that point.
Yeah.
But as I've gotten older, I can see the benefits of that type of approach, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you definitely attract more bees with honey than you do with dog poo. So I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
I believe in the nonviolent way.
Really?
I mean, you know, well, back in the, you know, I definitely had my scuffles back in the day, and, you know, but I think at the heart of who I am, I would probably be, I'd rather talk it out. You know what I mean? When I fought, I was just being a fool. So, well, that's when the temper gets the best of you, right?
So
you got to find a balance somewhere. And I think that's what, he represented. I mean, it's hard to say. I guess now that I'm older now, of course, I think I'm going to go that way. But, you know, I don't know about the spirit of the times. Who knows?
Yeah. And I think it also would have depended where we were and who we were exposed to.
Yeah.
But
we also kept to ourselves. Like, you know, we had our circle of friends, but we were always, you know, we did our own thing, I guess.
Well, even in the sense, like, actually, before we go, before I say what I was about to say, you know, Bayard gave me some serious Walter Borden vibes, man.
Yeah, big time, big.
You know what I mean? Like, just his manner, like the way that Coleman Domingo played him, his energy was very much like a Walter Borden, very theatrical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if I've never seen any video of Rustin. But the way that Coleman Domingo played him definitely was like a Walter Borden-esque type of thing. And even like I you know, you can even say Walter Borden is our version
The Bayard Rustin.
Bayard Rustin.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
Because he was in the background. Like, if you want to look at it like that, right? Where Rocky Jones was in the forefront.
Yeah.
In Nova Scotia and Halifax,
yeah,
right?
Totally. Yeah, and Walter Borden had a huge presence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I even remember him in, you know, growing up in the church and stuff. You could always, he was always around,
mm-hmm.
you know? And
yeah.
But no, you're totally right. That's totally Walter Borden vibes. There was a lot of presence in Domingo's performance as well, which, you know, Walter Borden, you know, he speaks and you're just like, boom. It's like, reminds me of James Earl Jones, like, you know, that definitive kind of presence.
Yeah, but, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, what I was going to say is, like not like taking ourselves, like our young selves, our 20 year old selves, and putting us into the 60s era in Halifax, because there was a lot of this civil rights activism going on in Halifax in the mid to late 60s, especially when it centered around the wrongs that were going on in Africville,
mm-hmm.
the amount of protests and you know, that were going on for that. You know, I think I would have been there in that sense. I think I would have been going to the protests and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. I think if I was, you know, back then, and I think in that time, my family was actually still living in the North End. So I would have been exposed to a different environment that I actually grew up in. And I grew up in that environment as well, because I went to church every Sunday. Hmm. But, you know, I think my temperament probably would have been a bit different if I lived amongst it all the time, instead of growing up in a mostly white neighborhood like I did, you know? So, but you know, it still existed though. I remember you just being young and witnessing racism, you know? So, when I was young, I hated it. Like I remember it having a profound effect on me. And the only way I was able to sort of, get it away was I became sort of like the funny dude, right? I mean, everyone liked me. So, but I don't know if I would have had that attitude if I had the strength in numbers, you know, if I was engaged in the black community, especially in my 20s. Oh, Lord. Yeah.
All right. Well, any final thoughts on the movie?
I just thought the movie was well depicted. It was good to see a lot of good black actors in there. Jeffrey Wright. There was even a female at the beginning. I don't know her name, but she was the older woman. She came in with the thing, the headdress over her, like the handkerchief.
Yeah.
And she was an older woman. She's actually Canadian, so she's a well-known Canadian actress, like a sort of like a character actor. So that was also cool to see. And it was just also good to see that a black story got told, and you know, and according to your research, not of a lot of it was embellished, like, you know, Hollywood can be. So I appreciate the fact that these stories are being told, and I learned something I did not know about, and it just shows a lot of pride in what the blacks did to try to overcome.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was, I didn't know it was a biopic.
Yeah.
I didn't know if it was part biopic, part documentary, mm-hmm. which I thought it was going to be, but you know, I don't mind, like a dramatized biopic. That's fine. Yeah. I think it was done tastefully.
Yeah.
So that's good. But it was produced by the Obamas.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, well, yeah, that's, So they're, I think that was part of their Netflix deal that they signed, right? So,
yeah.
Good on them. We'll see what else they got coming.
Yeah. I think they do. Yeah. Have more in the, more in the queue. So,
yeah. Cool.
Breaking new ground.
You have been listening to Down Home. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
On a high plateau, from the one down below to the future of the funk, getting lost in the flow. Contact with the spot, my gex. Now it's time to flex with the force from the soul, reaching all aspects, getting deep, no time to sleep as you reach your next phase, laying it all on the line. New trail start to blaze, it's a fire inside, a brand new path, breaking down the sum to one, feeling free. I just laugh with the joy.
The song Breaking New Ground from The Breakdown.
The vibe like magic prescribed, only to see the perfect blend, like a diamond in the rough, ready to drop a perfect gem. It's time to shine so fine, to see what you find. Revolution.